It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And as we head into the holiday season, we still have a lot of legal issues to discuss. And so with that, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins with us this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal. And as I begin the program, just to remind you, do not hesitate to give them a call. 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And with that brief introduction, a good afternoon to you, Cecil and Wes.
Lockwood, Wes and I today are going to talk about, interestingly, you and me were visiting for a minute before we started recording, and our topic is similar to our discussion about, you know, if you will, the big Roman numeral, community living. Uh-huh. Now, within community living, there are homeowner associations, and they are sometimes part of a planned community act. There's a lot of statutory material mm-hmm. on these entities, but I think that they are so very popular now, very, very popular in terms of the way in which not only our aging community choose to live in these townhome-like communities, But even younger people can choose to live there and raise a small family. So community living is very popular. It is living within the context of a democracy. One vote, if you will. You do have a vote. But other people beside you, on the right, on the left, above you, beyond you, they also have a vote. Uh-huh. And so we can only imagine that at times our law firm is brought into the center of some of the debates that occur, some of the conflicts that occur. We've had a lot of different files. They all tend to be rather unique. But let's talk about that today. Let's talk about some of the aspects of community living, homeowner association, planned developments, things of that nature. Wes, your desk is just full of these files, isn't it?
Right. We deal with this type of representation quite often, you know, and sometimes we're representing a group of individuals in the association or property owner. Sometimes we represent the association itself. But the manner in which these planned communities govern themselves is quite a it can be confusing. We deal with it quite frequently, but whenever I meet with an initial consultation type meeting with a client, they normally come in with lots of ideas regarding their governance and what they can do and what they can't do, and may have heard the Planned Community Act, and they're normally pretty far off as far as how it all works together. So basically, you know, when we have a planned community, Lockwood, it's not just necessarily just a homeowners association. You know, it could be like condo association and other types of planned ownership communities where you have covenants or declarations in place that allow the association to assess for dues. Okay, that's kind of like the primary issue you look at to see if you're a planned community or not. So, you know, if you don't have dues in place, then, or you don't have covenants in place to allow folks or to require folks to pay into the association to cover common expenses, then you're not really covered under the Planned Community Act. That's not what it's designed to deal with. And sometimes we see that associations are set up where there's just, you know, the developer develops the property, the developer, you know, divides out the multiple lots and sells off the lots, but there's never any intent really to have an association put in place, meaning like a nonprofit, like the ABC Community Association in place. There's just covenants in place that restrict certain uses. And I've seen that not maybe 10% of the time, 20% of the time at most, where that's the intent. And then you have like a, that then puts you in a situation where the property owners can enforce the covenants themselves. I mean, that puts neighbors in a very precarious situation. Mm-hmm. But like things like limitation on sizes of homes, you know, types of homes, setbacks, outbuildings, you know, whether you can have, you know, boats in the driveway or RV in the backyard or whatever, you know, those kind of things. Sometimes you're set up where you don't, there's never an intent to have an association to require dues. Well, if you're in that type of situation, then you're going to have, your streets are not going to be owned by the association. They're going to be public streets that are maintained, you know, probably by the state, most likely. You're not going to have common areas. There's not going to be like a tennis court area or a pool area or even common area, because you don't have money to maintain it. So, but most of these associations are set up, you know, through the governing documents. And when we say the governing documents, we're really primarily talking about the declarations / covenants, same type, same synonymous there as far as the document that, you know, goes on record and then restricts the use of the property, talks about the association governing, and then allows for the assessments. And so that's what brings us into the, you know, being a planned community. So if we're a planned community that was established, and this means when the declarations, the covenants were put on record from January 1st of 1999 or any time after, and we're 20 lots or more, it might be more than 20 lots. I know the cutoff is 20, so mm-hmm. It's either 20 or 21. I'd have to look at it. Then you fall into the Planned Community Act. And so what that's under 47F. That's just the North Carolina General Statute. We also have, you know, a similar type act for condominiums. Condominiums are a little different, but still a similar type act. I think that's 47C. But under 47F, that gives the association additional powers. Like, for example, let's say that we had, you know, covenants in place that allow for assessments and have all the standard language that says that, okay, you've got to pay, you know, whatever, $100 a year, can't go up more than 20% in any given year, mm-hmm. and whatever the amount is, and all of that standard language. And then you've got a property owner who has entirely violated the covenants based on what they built on the property, what they're keeping on the property. They're just, you know, sticking out like a sore thumb. Mm-hmm. Okay? They're basically just not managing their property well. And you've got a nice, you know, community. You've got all the houses kind of generally look the same. Everybody's maintaining their things. They're not building within setbacks. And then, let's say there's like no fences allowed, something like that.
Right.
Then you've got the one. Then you got the one guy who just is breaking all the rules. Well, if you are in that situation and you don't have language in those covenants that specifically provides for a mechanism to enforce those covenants, then if you don't have that language and you don't fit into the Planned Community Act, then the only remedy is to sue the person. That right. means you have to sue them for breach of contract, breach mm-hmm. of covenants. Well, you know, who really wants to do that? You know, and go through the process of a lawsuit and expense and those type things. That's kind of inefficient. Okay, so the Planned Community Act, if we fall under that, under this same scenario, meaning that, you know, we've got more than the 20 lots and we were set up after January 1st, 99, but although there are some provisions, including this provision that actually, that I'm about to talk about, actually applies to all planned communities. So there's certain carve-outs as far as how it applies.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say the Planned Community Act does apply, then the association would have this right. They would have the right to put this property owner on notice of, in writing, of what the problems are. You know, you've broken this rule, you've broken that rule, you've broken this rule. We're going to have a hearing on whatever, January 5th, 2026.
Mm.
This is where it's going to be. It's going to be before our board of directors or the adjudicatory panel. You can have a panel. It's like a committee. Hear it. And that's your opportunity to come forward and put evidence on before us as to why you're not in violation of the covenants. And so that's kind of the due process.
Mm-hmm.
So once you go through that, and let's say that the board of directors makes a decision after hearing that evidence that yes, you are in violation of these, let's say, five different things, and we've made the determination that we're going to fine you for that until you basically purge yourself of this, meaning fix the problems, then that gives the association that right to do that up to $100 a day for each violation.
Wow.
So that's quite a deterrent, and it's quite a incentive for this property owner to bring their property into conformance with the declarations, with the covenants.
Mm-hmm.
So then that fining process starts after 5 days of giving them notice of the problems and the determination and the amount of the fine, not to exceed $100 per violation. And that's a lien on the property. That becomes a lien on the person's property. So what does that mean for our listeners? Well, that means that there's notice put on the chain of, in the chain of title on the property that these fines are being assessed, and that if the person attempts to sell the property, then those are going to have to be paid before the new buyer takes good, clear, marketable title. Okay, well, let's say that we go on here for a year. And let's say that $100 a day has run for a year and our fines are up to $36,000.
Right.
Well, or $10,000 after 100 days or, you know, whatever the amount may be. Well, the association under the Planned Community Act would at that point in time, and really at any point in time, have the right to foreclose on the property.
Mm-hmm.
They would have the right to sell the property in order to pay the lien. That's just like any other foreclosure under our Judicial Sales Act, where basically, you know, you give the proper notice. There is a foreclosure trustee appointed, and you go through the process of selling it. So, you know, you kind of keep in mind that those remedies there are only available if you're subject to the Planned Community Act. And then also, if you contrast that to the situation where you're in a community that doesn't have an association, either you're not organized as an association, or there was never an intent to have an association because you've got like public roads, that kind of
right.
thing,
mm-hmm.
then you don't have the Planned Community Act at your disposal. It's only under the nonprofit corporation that is set up to govern this association and its owners that the Planned Community Act and this finding process will be available. So you can't, one owner enforcing the covenants against another owner, you don't have that right to use the Planned Community Act to, you know, fine folks. Okay, so anyway, our General Assembly put this in place really kind of as a catch-all because, you know, back, you know, whenever associations became more prevalent, probably mm-hmm. in the 70s coming forward, 80s coming forward, and we saw more of, you know, these developments that popped up all over the place. And of course, here in where we are in Carter County, and really all around us in neighboring counties, and you see them all over the place. You know, this subdivision, that subdivision, this subdivision, that subdivision. But all of those are, you know, almost all of those are fall under these planned communities. Well, when these were set up, the attorneys who did that work, some of them did it really well, and some of them didn't do it as well.
Right.
You know, and so we run across these covenants as we're dealing with issues in subdivisions, you know, as an attorney's, you know, done. It could be any kind of issue that comes up, but you know, one of the first things that Harvell and Collins does when we're representing association is we immediately get a copy of the bylaws, the covenants, declarations, any amendments to it, and so because those are the governing documents. So anyway, the Planning Community Act got put in place really as a catch-all to protect these associations so they could operate properly.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes the covenants really did not include the language in them that was necessary in order to properly govern and properly, you know, get this association, you know, running properly. And that's pretty important when, in many cases, most cases, the home is the person's biggest investment.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, and when they buy into the ABC subdivision, well, they're relying upon things to be run properly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you've got a situation where all of a sudden, you know, you lose your covenants, for example, I mean, I've dealt with one subdivision now for 20 years or more in Carter County that lost its covenants years ago because of a legal problem. You know, the property values are hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of this is created so that there is something to rely upon, and the Planning Community Act is a fallback so that we have, you know, some continuity, some control, some organization, so our property values are maintained, so that, you know, there's, you know, one neighbor's use of their property doesn't negatively affect others. You know, another thing that we see sometimes is people want to use their residence overtly as a business.
Right.
You know, and they've got, you know, whatever it may be, you know, four HVAC vans parked there every day.
Yep.
You know, just things like that. So it's important to understand the dynamic of the declarations, the bylaws, the Planning Community Act. And that, you know, if you kind of stay on top of those things and stay organized as an association, then you really don't have to ever, you know, kind of take that nuclear option of having to sue someone. We'd like to avoid that if we can. I mean, obviously we don't shy away from it if it's necessary. But the benefits of the Planning Community Act, you know, help you, you know, really stay away from, you know, having to go, you know, down that path.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and that's Wes Collins. We're talking about the issue of community living and homeowners associations. And I'm interested in this for a variety of reasons. I know that this has been a topic of discussion in the North Carolina legislature, as a matter of fact, just in the past year. Wes, in instances where you have, let me step aside, you use the word plain, as in PLAIN, Community Act, or is it Planned Community Act? I'm sorry.
Planned, right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. The question I have is, if you have the Community Act, and you have, of course, an association management group, homeowners, I'm thinking, possibly, this is a twofer. Could they then farm this out to a third party to manage the association, and or would the local association, the local members manage it? And what does a homeowner do if they're not satisfied with the management on the part of the association elected officials and things of this nature? Is there recourse?
That's a multifaceted great question, because I get that all the time. Yes, first of all, oftentimes associations do, as you say, farm out the management responsibilities to a management company.
Okay.
Okay, that happens quite frequently. So in the event we have a management company that is dealing with the management, the day-to-day of the association, and we have a owner, for example, like you asked, that's not happy with the management, what recourse would that owner have? Well, the recourse is to organize and get on the board.
Mm-hmm.
Not of the management company, but of the association.
Right.
Or get their candidate on the board. If it's egregious, like money's being stolen, mm-hmm. or there's just, you know, significant breaches of the declarations or bylaws, or things are being done that are just, you know, not in the best interest of the association, then there are procedures for a petition and vote to remove board members. So there's a number of things that can be done there, but it all comes back to the board of directors. Uh-huh. Because the board of directors governs the association, not the management company.
Okay.
Now, sometimes there's some confusion about that. But the board of directors hires and fires. I mean, the management company is hired by the association,
mm-hmm.
to do, you know, whatever is within the scope of their contract. So if the association, through its board of directors, decides, hey, this, I'm not happy with this management company, because they're not managing our money well, they're not giving us good legal advice on things, if they're even giving legal advice. And oftentimes I see management companies pour over into that.
Right.
Where they're maybe advising about the Planning Committee Act and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, frankly, I see a lot of mistakes being made there. Because
right.
Management, I mean, you know, it's just kind of the way it is. I'm not trying to disparage anyone, not using any names here.
Right.
But, you know, management companies are more aligned with doing things like, and more adept at doing things like controlling the money,
mm-hmm.
collecting dues, maybe sending letters out to individual property owners if there's a violation. But when you get much deeper than that, then oftentimes I see management companies kind of misstep, because that's not really their area of expertise, and
right.
it may not even be their area that they've been contracted to handle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so,
okay. The other question then goes to, and of course, we haven't touched on it, but the issue of liability. And for example, in circumstances where you have a common area, and again, we're talking with, this is Wes Collins, but Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, but in instances of a homeowner, and we're going to touch on that briefly here as well, I'm curious about that, but looking at the responsibility of liability and liability insurance, for example, a common area of a swimming pool, which is an attractive nuisance in some descriptions, but what happens in those instances where, how does liability handled in these homeowners or these property or community developments?
Well, liability can be, there could be all kind of liability. There could be officer and director liability.
Uh-huh.
There could be liability with regard to the property itself. The first line of defense, of course, when we talk about liability is,
insurance.
As we know in our society, is insurance.
Right.
So obviously, an association through its board of directors getting with a competent insurance provider to assess the liability and mm-hmm. to, you know, quote the type of insurance that would help cover in the event of a liability relative to the board or someone getting hurt, those kind of things mm-hmm. is imperative, you know, to do that and have that in place. And that would be part of these common expenses for which the, you know, the association would be assessing folks for their dues.
Right. Okay.
Liability with regard to condo associations is a little bit different because it gets more complex, mm-hmm. because when you live in a normal subdivision, you own your lot, you own your house, you own everything thereon, but superimposed upon that ownership interest is the declarations that do restrict and limit your development of your property.
Mm-hmm.
You contrast that with a condo. Well, as far as a condo goes, so go back to the house just a second. So if you're just talking about a house, then you're paying for your own insurance because you own your own home, your land, so on and so forth. So that's individually. But when you're talking about a condo, you own the interior.
Mm-hmm.
And then the association is responsible for the exterior. Okay. And there's, sometimes a fine line between where the interior stops and where the exterior begins. Mm-hmm. That sometimes is a legal argument depending on the circumstances. But insurance is a huge deal there. Think about all these condos on the beach.
Right.
Well, when the hurricanes come along, you better have your insurance in proper place.
Mm-hmm.
And so how is that covered? Well, the association has a legal responsibility to maintain the insurance. So when there's a loss, and this is kind of a pooled thing, it's like all of the members pay in their dues, and it's the association's responsibility to maintain that insurance for the exterior. And there are specific rules in place that under our statutes that indicate that when there's a claim, that those funds are common funds that come in and are to be used to deal with the common expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so that's a huge responsibility for an association because, you can't have an insurance claim for the exterior come in for a condo association, a condo building where there's 100 units. And the millions of dollars comes in on the claim because we had a hurricane and the association board of directors just decides to use the money willy nilly wherever they want
right.
to. They can't do that. They have to use it for the limits of the policy on the exterior because that's their responsibility. Now that may extend into the interior some depending on what the damage is and where the damage came from. Mm-hmm. And then by law, if there's any money left over after the claims have been made for whatever reason, then that has to be dispersed pro rata to all the property owners. So it gets complicated when you ask the question of insurance. That's kind of a powder keg. There's a lot of moving parts with that.
One final question for you, Wes. And again, this is Wes Collins we're talking with. Of Harvell and Collins, Cecil with us as well. We're talking about community living, homeowners association, things of this nature. one of the things I'm thinking about also, Wes, is that when someone's thinking about buying into a community development, a homeowners association, it would be wise to sit down with you and go over these documents, would it not, before they make that final signature on the purchase line?
Yeah, I think that, whenever you buy property, you need to know what you're buying, obviously.
Right.
You're not just going to go look at the house and look at the neighborhood and drive through. All those are incredibly important things. You're going to also get a copy of the covenants and declarations.
Mm-hmm.
And going over that with an attorney, yeah, that's a good idea. There's no doubt about that. So you're not surprised later on. You're going to look closely at your residential property disclosure statement. Okay. That's the document that indicates whether there are problems with the home, whether mm-hmm. there are any special assessments coming up, those kind of things.
Okay.
And you don't want to blindly buy into, a home, a subdivision that has, let's say, a wastewater treatment system that they have to maintain
uh-huh.
that's 30, 35, 40 years old, and there's an assessment coming down the pike $25,000 a unit, and you didn't know that. You got to do your due diligence.
Right.
So, yes, I mean, it's important to go through those things. Now, if you've got a good realtor, the realtor can help you with that. Normally, a good realtor is going to know the neighborhood and know what the issues are. Mm-hmm. They're going to help you look at the residential property disclosure statement. They're going to help get a copy of the covenants for you. They may even help you with regard to making a phone call to the association or to the management company to determine if there's anything unusual going on that any potential buyer might know about. So that would be your first line of defense, is rely upon your realtor. But it could be that another additional thing you would want to do is have an attorney go over those covenants, you know, with you, so you make sure you know what your responsibilities are going to be and what your limits on what you want to, what you can do on the property are clear.
All right, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and of course that's Wes Collins with us this afternoon on the issue of community living, homeowners association. Wes, as we wrap it up, I'm gathering that it's been a pretty active year in that regard, that there's growing interest in basically community living, community developments. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that, Lockwood. I think, and I also think that we're just on the cusp of this chosen way to live. As you know, out here where we live, yeah. And you live there too, as does Wes, and so many of our good and wonderful friends, there are several community living developments, you know, under construction as we speak. I mean, you know, yes, there's a lot of single-family dwelling construction in eastern North Carolina, but it's astonishing the amount of construction that is within the context of this community living, be it a condominium or a townhome or a cottage home, whatever, right. whatever we want to call it. They're extraordinarily popular, and my opinion is that they're getting more and more popular.
Which means that, quite frankly, we need to pay close attention. All the more reason why we do this with Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And that was Cecil Harvell a moment ago. I want to thank both of you. And as we are watching the construction and development here in eastern North Carolina, and particularly here in Carteret County, to your point, we need to be very aware. Not that it's a bad thing, but just be more aware. I want to thank both of you for your time this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal. Again, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And with that, Will, I will talk to you next week.
Yes. Thank you, Lockwood.
Thank you.